talk about throwing fuel on fire. I mean, Kitson was the wrong man, the wrong place at the wrong time. They literally had a license to kill. Literally. They would go out and they'd steal cars. They would get unmarked cars. They would use unattributable guns, not military issue guns. And they'd go by these barricades and they'd shoot. In Kenya, he was able to go into the jungles with the local guides, if you want, and find the enemy. And in Belfast, he was able to do the same thing, but in the personnel carriers and find the Republican enemy.
David, thank you very much for joining me. Thanks for sending me the book. Great read.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You might tell us the name there.
Kitson's Irish War, mastermind of the dirty war in Ireland.
Very good. Yeah, great read. If anyone, the book obviously mainly focuses on Kitson, a lot on the MRF who are in the news lately. But it goes way beyond that. It goes into a lot of the dirty war type tactics and a lot of these figures who are kind of tangentially linked to Kitson as well.
Well, Kitson. A lot of people kind of give Kitson the credit, if you could call it that, for these type of dirty tricks. But they've been going on since biblical times. There's nothing new about them. What he did was adapt them really for a modern Western European setting, namely Northern Ireland. But they had been in use for hundreds and hundreds of years. They were in use by the military, by the Navy as well, in the First World War. They used to dress up gunboats as merchant shippers to try and attract U-boats, the German U-boats, the original World War One U-boats, and they were known as Q-boats. And then later on in the Middle East, when the British were fighting the Jewish rebels, they set up Q patrols and they used them to infiltrate. And it's exactly the same thing. I can explain what they did in a moment, but it was pretty much exactly the same type of thing that took place then with the MRF in Ireland later on. So there's nothing new about the techniques. What Kitson did was he studied it, he advanced it, he developed it, and very indiscreetly. And not only wrote a book, you can well understand how military figures would write books for internal readers, but he actually published it, which was astonishing. And of course, that immediately drew attention to himself, and everybody then was focused on him. Everyone was looking at him, and it drew an awful lot of attention to him. I'm sure he really regretted publishing the book at that time. Anyway,
we're talking about low intensity operations.
Low intensity operations, absolutely, yeah. He was right. He was writing that at the tail end of the 1960s, under the tutelage of someone in Oxford, a professor of the history of war. And there was an arrangement whereby he was going to get 50% of the royalties, and that might have been what prompted him to publish it, make a few quid out of it. And I think it probably sold well after he came to Ireland, and probably there were more sales in Ireland than anywhere else. And I'm sure fellas, Republicans in Belfast were buying the copy wholesale, and it backfired on him badly. He's a very interesting character, Kitson, though. People have said to me, well, do you think that he come from another era? Well, in a way, looking back at him now, certainly yes. But he was born in 1926. He only died there, of course, a few months ago. He was 97, I think. And he was from a family which had two centuries of service to the British Navy. And this was just imbued in him. And he went to Stow, which was one of these boarding schools, which was set up to breed young men to go out and rule the waves, rule the colonies. And the whole thing was steeped in colonial attitudes, disdainful attitudes, racist attitudes, I suppose, would probably be the most accurate way to describe it. And Kitson took to Stow like a duck to water. He became head boy. He was involved in all types of sporting activities. He was involved in blood sports and hunting. It started at Stow and went on thereafter. So he would have had a very low attitude of anybody who wasn't British. And I think that showed then in the career he chose. He couldn't go into the Navy. He said that that caused a bit of a stir in his family because the tradition looked for a while like it was going to be broken, and instead he went into the military. Now, his brother, he had a younger brother who went into the Navy, so family honor was preserved. And he was too young. He missed the Second World War, but he was in Germany very shortly afterwards, and then by the 1950s he was chosen to go to Kenya. And at the time, the Mau Mau rebellion was in full flight, and that was where he really, really found his vocation, as he would have seen it in life. And I was talking earlier on about the deception operations that had been used, for example, against the submarines, and similar types of deception operations had been, it goes back to biblical times. And what the British were fighting in Kenya wasn't a straightforward war. It was a war against an enemy that quite literally could disappear back into the jungle and come backwards and forwards. So they had to find a new way of fighting it. This wasn't like fighting the Zulu or anything like that. And one of the techniques that Kitson perfected, you could say, I don't like using that word, but I can't really think of a better one because there's nothing perfect about this. It's actually quite horrific. But they would suborn locals. They would get Mau Mau, they would turn them, they would recruit people who maybe weren't Mau Mau at all. Variety, very flexible organization, the pseudo gangs that Kitson was running. But essentially, they would dress and behave as if they were Kenyans, and they would be able to move around the jungles, move around the villages, move along rivers, and they would find where these units were. And then they would take them out, or they'd call their colleagues in to take them out, or they'd take them out jointly. And it was very, very successful. And incredibly, in 1960, I think it was, Kitson wrote a book about this and gave speeches and lectures. And he was so successful, he got various commendations. And he became shortly thereafter the counterinsurgency expert, intelligence gathering expert, an adaptable man. He was, of course, then sent to Malaya, where he did exactly the same thing. He wrote two books which would feature his African and Malaysian experiences. Well, sorry, the first book is exclusively Kenyan, and when you read it, I quote a little bit from it in the book. You can see the racism of the man coming through, referring to people as monkeys, expressing surprise that black people were allowed into the church.
Jesus, bro.
Ready, sorry, John.
Oh, I was saying Jesus, yeah. Well,
Oh,
fucking
sorry.
hell.
I mean, yeah, ex pretty much blaming the Mau Mau rebellion, not on the fact that they had had land for centuries and it was suddenly being taken from them and turned into coffee plantations, but no. There's all got to do with witch doctors, and they were savages, and he describes some of the tribes that intermixed, that they produced half breeds, and they all had syphilis. And this was his view of the Kenyan people. I know a few Kenyan people. They're wonderful people. They're lovely people. Great, rich history. They would not recognize themselves if they were to read Kitson's books. They'd be horrified, I'm sure. Quite horrified.
Actually, on that note, in your book, I read about some practices in interrogation and torture. Not that people in the north throughout the Troubles weren't interrogated in terrible ways and tortured, but some of them that you read about in Kenya, you just simply couldn't get away with them in like an English speaking Western country, like dragging fellas, ch chaining a fella to a car and dragging him along the road. And I heard interrogating women, they would putting things in their vaginal
Rats,
area.
rats. Oh, it's absolutely shocking. One British soldier who reviewed the book gave out and criticized it because it wasn't the white soldiers who did that, it was the black soldiers working for the British that did that type of thing, you see. So I mean, even now, soldiers who are out there, they still can't say what they did was wrong. Can I read you one quote from it? Now, it's not from my book. I quote
Please
it in
do,
my book. It'll take about a minute, but I think it sums up something that I when I read it, I was horrified. I wasn't able at that point in time to finish reading David Anderson's book. It's called Histories of the Hanged, and he described how a police officer was interviewing three suspects, and here's the quote: "One of them, A tall, cold, black bastard kept grinning at me, real insolent. I slapped him hard, but he kept on grinning at me, so I kicked him in the balls as hard as I could. When he finally got up on his feet, he grinned at me again, and I snapped. I really did. I stuck my revolver in his grinning mouth, and I pulled the trigger. His brains went all over the side of the police station. The other two suspects were standing there looking blank, so I shot them both. When the sub-inspector drove up, I told him the suspects tried to escape. He didn't believe me, but all he said was, "Bury them and see the wall is cleaned up." So that's the type of
Oh.
barbarity that was taking place. Kitson wasn't involved in anything as bad as that, at least as far as we know. But he arrives in there and still sees this as Her Majesty's territory. These are the witch doctor, half inbred savages, and we're going to put manners on them. And there's no admission in his books. There's no real acknowledgement at all that that type of behavior was going on. He describes hunting people in his much later book, the 1997 one, as a bunch of five. He calls that book as like hunting an animal, and had the great satisfaction they had when they caught these prey. Quite inhumane. After Kenya and after Malaya, he did various things, but at one stage he was asked to help suppress a rebellion that was taking place in Oman. And at that time, Oman was run by a sultan, but it was really an asset of the British Empire, and slavery was still allowed. And he quite nonchalantly describes making his way to meet the brother of the sultan and visiting a castle, and the castle had a dungeon in it, and in the dungeon were slaves. Now, some of the stories about the slavery in Oman at that time, it's all changed now, of course, but at that time, absolutely horrific. But Kitson doesn't comment on this. He doesn't bat an eyelid. Instead, when he meets the man who's overseeing these slaves and has them in his castle, he goes on about what a great fellow he was and describes his jaw and how determined he was and how they set about making plans. Now, well, in the event, Kitson's plan didn't come to fruition. God knows what it might have involved, but it didn't come to fruition because while the planning was going on, the SAS were out there. They succeeded and they attacked the rebel strongholds, and they put that down. His next notable, for me anyway, next notable port of call was in Cyprus. Now, at that stage, he was working as a peacekeeper, and there are no kits and horror stories there. But what's hugely interesting, I thought anyway, when I examined this, was the obsession the man had developed with intelligence gathering. And he wanted to know absolutely everything he could possibly find out about everybody. He doesn't strike me as the man who ever could relax, take time off. In fact, when he was in Kenya, he had to be ordered to take time off. That's on his military record, because he was obsessed with his work in a way that's just not healthy, really. In Cyprus, he impressed a guy who'll become important again, Lord Carver. We'll come back to him perhaps in a moment. Anyway, he got index cards going, he got files going, he was reading newspapers, he got his men to collect even the nicknames of people on the streets. If somebody got a new phone line, or if there was a phone line going into an unusual area, he wanted to know everything about it. So he had, I describe it as kind of drift net intelligence gathering. And of course, when he got to Belfast, he was doing exactly the same thing. By the time he came to Belfast, they made the plan to send him to Belfast in June of 1960. And a lot of people, including myself, thought initially that, well, that's probably the Tory party won the Heath came back, won the or Heath became Prime Minister, having won the June 1970 election. But I was always a little bit of my own mind doubtful about that, because I mean, could they have moved so quickly? Would this have been at the very, very top of their agenda? So I looked into it a little bit more, and I found out that it was Carver who had decided to send Kitson to Northern Ireland, and it was not because of the Tory party returning. I've a soft spot for Harold Wilson and Jim Callaghan, who was the Home Secretary and later became British Prime Minister for a few years before Thatcher came in, because I really think they were doing their best, and they were on the right track in trying to calm down everything in Northern Ireland after the troubles had erupted. I traced the troubles really back to 1966, when that knot of militant loyalists surrounding Ian Paisley and people like Gusty Spence, and that they set up the UVF. And at the time, the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland was a guy called Captain Terence O'Neill. He'd be seen as very much as a liberal. Some people say that the Alliance Party roots can really be traced back to him. And his idea was, let's get the two communities together. Let's make friends. And there was visits from Sean Lamassa, the Irish Taoiseach, and all the rest of it. And this was seen as a betrayal by the extremists. And at first, they weren't successful. In 1966, they committed a few murders, and the RUC found them, tracked them down, arrested them, put them in prison. But by 1968, the same gang had reformed without the men in prison, obviously. And by 1969, they had managed to tear down the government of O'Neill, and you had huge tensions growing, all because the nationalist people wanted their civil rights, which I suppose essentially boils down to one man, one vote, and jobs, and a fair allocation of housing. It wasn't an awful lot to ask for. But to the likes of Paisley and William McGrath and John McCaig and all of these other crackpots and awful people, and I can prove that if you want in a few minutes, the civil rights were nothing more than it's a front for the IRA. And these guys were so crazy, they believed the Vatican and Fianna Fáil and the IRA were all in a plot. I mean, it is laughable, John, but they actually believed it. They also believed they were the lost tribe of Israel. I mean, we're talking about total nutcases here. And they whipped tensions up, and well, we all know what happened by August of 1969. So I was favourably disposed a moment ago. I was describing myself as favourably disposed towards Harold Wilson and James Callaghan. They were smart guys. They came in, they knew this was wrong, and they shut down the B Specials, who were behind an awful lot of the violence. They took the arms away from the RUC, and they put an awful lot of pressure on the Stormont Unionist government to start enacting civil rights. And that was the approach they were taking. And sure, we all famously know that it was the British Army who stepped in to protect the nationalists from the likes of Paisley and McCaig and the others. And I was explaining this to an English friend of mine. He was absolutely astonished that the soldiers were getting the famous cups of tea and sandwiches. And some of them that winter, it was still going well. By the winter of 1969, it was still going well. Soldiers were being invited in for Christmas dinners in certain nationalist areas. And then frictions began to occur. And I think that's a much, 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 much wider area to look at. So we won't analyse that, because we're looking at Kitson, I think, primarily here today. So the tensions were rising, rising, rising. And unfortunately, in my view, the Tories win the election instead of Labour, and Kitson comes in to take over the military. And the corn, that's it. That's when everything really, really goes wrong. I mean, it wasn't perfect beforehand, but the situation was, it could have been calmed down, but no. Kitson's experience had been in suppressing opposition to the Crown. And that's what he was. Experienced that, and he was seen as a great guru, but in the counterinsurgency world. But when he came to Belfast, because he was in charge of 39 Brigade, which was based in Belfast and its environs, his task wasn't to defeat one side. He was meant to be a peacekeeper. He wasn't meant to, and he shouldn't have sided with one side against the other. He shouldn't have nominated one side as the enemy and gone to war with them. But this was all he knew. This was all his training. And I went to some pains earlier on to describe him describing people in Africa in very derogatory terms and people in Malaysia as well in very derogatory terms. And he had a very poor view of the Irish. And he says in Low Intensity Operations, I think it's in Low Intensity Operations, but it's one of his books anyway, where that the British Army had been brought into existence to suppress the Irish and preserve the Protestant religion. So if that's the attitude, yeah, if that's the attitude you have, this guy's not there to try and make the peace. Now, in the book, I do describe when he came first and he arrived and he took over in September of 1970, he did engage in some of the hearts and mind operations. There's no doubt about that, he did. But there was a hunter lurking behind that mask, waiting to get out. And you can sense it, you can feel it, you can see it in his later writings. And the first thing he did was set up the MRF. There's great confusion about what the name of the MRF is, Military Reaction Force, Military Reconnaissance Force. I think it's called, the absolutely correct name might be the Mobile Reaction Force, but we'll just call it the MRF because that's certainly correct.
It's
And
interesting. In keeping with the whole secretive clandestine thing, yeah. Same. We'll speak about them later. But same with the Freds. I don't think it's known the origin of the Freds.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. I certainly don't know what the origin of the name of the Freds. But do you remember I described how they would get local people in Kenya who looked obviously looked local, and they could go in and they could go out. Well, that was very, very easy for British soldiers in Belfast to look like locals. So they'd dress up as tramps and they would walk around. And the first iteration of it, they were called the bomb squad, and they were out there looking, watching, monitoring for people who might be carrying bombs, bringing bombs. But then that elevated into the military reaction force. And everybody who looks at this area has suspected and known, believed rather, that Kitson was involved in it. Now, Kieran McGart with Paper Trail, a superb man for digging things out of the archives, he found a paper by Kitson, and Kitson's writing to a terribly interesting guy called Howard Smith. I'll tell you about him in a moment. But Kitson writes about how he's setting up the MRF. Now, that is Kieran McGart's discovery puts it absolutely beyond any question or doubt. Not that there ever was any, that Kitson was the person behind this. The reason some people in the past have doubted it is because Kitson left Belfast in April of 1972, and the MRF killings really didn't start until a little bit later in the summer of 1972. Will we go back to your man Harold Smith for a moment? Because this was a guy who great interplay with Kitson.
Yeah, please.
Harold Smith was what was known as the United Kingdom representative to the government of Northern Ireland, UK rep. That's what he was known, and he was the third of them, and he was the only one appointed by Heath, and Heath would have known him. Smith was Foreign Office diplomat. He'd been all over Eastern Europe and that. Now, in later years, after this, he became the head of MI5, but he wasn't a long-term MI5 officer. He was in the Foreign Office. And one of the duties he had was to take care of the Congo desk. And at the time, CIA and MI6, which is the Overseas Intelligence Service attached to the Foreign Office, were very much opposed to the administration run by Patrice Lumumba. And they had him, ultimately had him killed in a joint CIA MI6 coup involving a lady called Dame Daphne Park. And my late friend Paddy Hayes has written a book about it, and he's described the plot and her involvement. But during the reporting about the victim, they described him as a socialist and how we'd have to get rid of him. And Smith, Howard Smith, was in the Foreign Office at that time. Now, this is the Howard Smith who's now running Northern Ireland. And he suggested in a paper that, well, one of the things we should be, basically, we should have him assassinated, we should have him killed, and that the quality of leaders who would follow after Patrice would be much of a much lesser order, and have him killed. And that paper was circulated to couple of politicians as well, one of whom was a junior foreign office minister, Ted Heath, who becomes prime minister. So you have Heath in charge, and he's prepared to countenance political assassination. You have his proconsul, if you like, Smith, running the entire show in Northern Ireland, and well known to Heath as somebody who has proposed murder. And if it's only on that one instance, it's still enough. And now you mix in with this, you mix in Kitson, and you have letters going backwards and then forwards from Kitson to Howard Smith describing how he's setting up the MRF. So he sets up the MRF, and it does quite a number of things. Some things you can't criticize. They're perfectly legitimate security exercises. They're going out, they're surveilling people, they're looking to stop people being bombed on the streets. That's totally positive, and no one can criticize that. Unless you're a supporter of the IRA, which I'm not, so I don't criticize them for that at all. But then they started shooting to kill, and the case that's coming up for trial soon, there was a Catholic ex-serviceman manning a barricade. He wasn't armed. He wasn't an IRA man. Nothing like that.
Is
They're very sorry.
Patrick McVeigh.
Oh, sorry. Yes, Pat. Yes, absolutely correct. Patrick McVeigh. And guys drive by their MRF. They shoot him. They kill him. And unfortunately for them, from their perspective, they were seen having been stopped later, very shortly afterwards, a few minutes later, at a military checkpoint. And they were able to show their warrant cards or whatever it was they had. So the game was up. People knew that the soldiers were involved, and then they had to admit this. And then they said, "Well, we were fired upon," and the usual story: blame the victim. There are various theories as to why he was shot. Who knows? Who knows? One theory was they mistook him for another a Republican. There certainly were other people shot by the MRF, and they looked very, very like well-known Republicans, and the belief is that these guys were, well, it's not a belief. These guys have pictures of known subversives, IRA people, up on the walls of their HQ at Palace Barracks, just outside Belfast, and they would go around the place roaming and shooting. Now, another thing they did, which was very, very close to what they did in Kenya. In Kenya, they would get people in big hoods, so they looked like the Ku Klux Klan, and they would put them into jeeps, and they'd drive them and then parade people in front of them, and they would be able to identify who was an imam and who wasn't. In Ireland, they did something a little bit similar, but they didn't use the Ku Klux Klan hoods. They put them behind curtains, or they took people out in personnel carriers. They have the slits, little slits at the back, so they would
In
be
the
dragged up
Saracens,
into. Yeah, exactly. And they might spot somebody, and then they would photograph them. And again, this was the, if I can use the metaphor, in Kenya, he was able to go into the jungles with the local guides, if you want, and find the enemy. And in Belfast, he was able to do the same thing, but in the personnel carriers, and find the Republican enemy, and photograph them. And possibly then that's how some of them might have had their photographs on the wall, and some of them might have been lined up for assassination. But he was gone. He was gone by April, and the shootings that I'm describing there now began in the summer of 72, give or take a few weeks. Kitson wasn't there, and the discipline wasn't right. Now, Kitson was a severe man. He was a strict disciplinarian, strickler for protocol and all the rest of it. And maybe the operations might have been run a bit more tightly, and they might have got away with them for a little bit longer if Kitson had been around. Perhaps not. Perhaps not. But the whole thing fell apart because the guys, remember a moment ago I spoke about the fellas in the vans going around, the personnel carriers looking around. They were called Freds. God knows why, but they were called Freds. And two of them, the IRA, eventually discovered that two of them, first of all, one of them, a fellow called Seamus Wright, they found out that he had fallen into the clutches of the MRF, and they lifted him, and he confirmed this. And he later then said, well, there's another guy who's doing this, and that was a guy called McKee. And they They lifted them, and between the jigs and the reels, they found out about two reasonably well, to people like me, very well known, I think, but even to the public, reasonably well known operations that were taking place in Belfast at the time. And they're quite ingenious. The first one was certainly quite ingenious. It was called the Four Square Laundry. I spoke to, when I was researching the book, I spoke to Colin Wallace, who had a peripheral involvement with the operation. You know, Colin Wallace, the PsyCops whistleblower.
I'd love to interview him sometime, yeah.
I'll arrange that for you, no problem. But anyway, so Colin describes how there was so much money coming in to, presumably, the money was, well, obviously he was based in Lisbon, so the money must have been coming back to be counted in Lisbon. And they didn't know what to do with it because they had, because of the whole thing was being financed, the laundry operation was being financed by the military. And the clothes were being washed by the military. All the money coming in was just, well, it wasn't been spent on anything, so it just kept growing and growing and growing. But why were they doing this? It sounds bizarre, doesn't it? Going around collecting laundry. No, very clever. They bring the laundry back. So if they suspected that House X had a bomb maker or somebody who was involved with the IRA, they get their laundry. They forensically test it. They have dogs sniffing. And they can pinpoint then who was and wasn't in the IRA. And in the laundry van, they had a secret compartment at the top of it, and the two fellas lying there, and they could take photographs. So the IRA discovered that this was afoot, and they also discovered that they were running brothel.
Brothel.
Now we come back to the brothel if you like in a moment, but they attacked the Four Square Laundry. I think it was in October 72. I could be wrong about that, but that type around about that time of the year. And the laundry van, there was a female soldier operating it, and she got away with her life. She ran into one of the houses, and the belief at the time was that she was a perfectly innocent person, and that the van had been attacked by loyalist gunmen. So she got away with her life. I think it felt, yeah, it was Tapper Stewart, Ted Stewart, or Tapper Stewart anyway, was in the compartment, and he was killed in the hail of bullets that struck the van. So that all fell apart. And at that stage, you know, the MRF was no longer in any way a secret to the public. I mean, the IRA knew about it clearly for a long time before then. The other operation isn't as well known as the laundry one, as the brothel one now. So to go back, in fact,
You took it
go
was called
back to the
Gemini, was it? I drive that one.
The Gemini. There was a guy called Bernie Silver, and he was one of the biggest pimps in Soho. Ran a massive empire, extraordinarily rich man, reputed to have killed at least six women in his time. Not a nice guy. Gangland, involved in murders, put on trial for murders, all of that. Bernie Silver was not a good guy, horrible man. But he got away with an awful lot for a long time, and he was quite successful. And clearly, he was playing games with the intelligence services, and definitely played games with the intelligence services in Northern Ireland. He was brought over in 1970, and he spent about 10 days in Belfast. And his task was to find suitable places for brothels. The Gemini was but one. There were at least three brothels, and there was one for homosexual clientele as well. And this was completely separate now to the Kinkora scandal, where doesn't bear thinking about what these people did, what they were prepared to do. The end really did justify the means. So anyway, Silver identifies these various good locations, and they start advertising this as a massage parlor. And then the Freds are arrested. The Freds knew about it. You see, the Freds were based in Palace Barracks, at least intermittently. They would go back out into the community, and they would go back into Palace Barracks. So they would, for example, they would see the Four Square Laundry van, and they would see the people driving it, and they would have known who was involved with it. I don't know exactly how they found out about the brothel, but anyway, so the IRA attacked that as well. They claimed that they killed somebody. Who knows? Because there was so much cover up going on afterwards. But people standing around afterwards saw men going in carrying out cameras and that. And the way it worked was they weren't filming people with the prostitutes in the brothel. They had an automatic camera that would take pictures every few seconds, click, click, click. And to get over the sound of the clicking, they had loud music pumping through the rooms. And a few years later, Bernie Silver is on trial for something in London, and one of the most senior Met police officers gives evidence on his behalf, saying that he was most helpful and helped us solve some murders in Belfast. And what the police officer was referring to there was that three soldiers had been lured away to a party. They'd been shot and killed. And there was a lot of gossip in the nationalist communities about who had done it. And one of the visitors to the Gemini spoke about it. And whether it was, there's two theories. One was it was just pillow talk wheedled out of the gentleman, or alternatively, they just blackmailed him and they showed him the photographs and said, "Now tell us what you know." And he told them what they know, including that. But anyway, that's how they found out. So there's no doubt that there's no doubt. I mean, there you have the admission in open court on oath, the police officer saying this man was helpful to us. So that's what that was about. I said earlier on that Kitson was involved in DriftNet intelligence gathering in Cyprus and elsewhere, of course. So this gives you an indication now of the scale of the operations that were taking place with him in Belfast. There was no holding this man back. Workaholic, obsessed with his job. And he spent all of his time thinking of ways of gathering intelligence. And
There's a very famous quote from Chairman Mao, terrible person, but he gets the quote about guerrilla warfare. He nails it. Like, he says that the guerrilla fighter is a fish, and he swims among the ocean, and the ocean being like the general population. Kitson had his own take on that quote, and he said that sometimes it's necessary, if you can't quite get to the fish, or if you're having difficulty doing that, to do something to the water, so to speak. You might tell us about some of these efforts. I think, in my opinion, like, there was a few too many of these drive-bys that ended up being completely innocent people for it to be just confusion. In my opinion, I do think that there was times when they just intentionally shot up innocent people in an area to convince them that it was loyalist or even IRA and break trust. So that would be in keeping with the doing something to the water part.
Okay, can I come back to that in kind of a circular way? I'll start with the Ballymurphy and then I'll come back to that. If you can't fish out the IRA activists, well, then you poison the water. You make it intolerable for them because insurgents can't operate without local support. In Malaya, they actually took entire communities and put them behind fences, barbed wire fences and that, and made them live in these special villages so that they couldn't feed food, literally couldn't feed the communist insurgents. Kitson made it intolerable for, or tried to make it intolerable for the Catholic or nationalist community to support the IRA. If they support the IRA, we're going to make life hell for them. That was his approach. And he did it across the board. And I have absolutely no doubt that that's what lies behind the Ballymurphy massacre. None whatsoever. When you have soldiers there, internment had taken place. There were riots in opposition to it. And people were out on the streets. And the soldiers then, they came in and they were shooting people left, right and centre. Shooting mothers. Shooting people on the ground. Just absolutely
Beating
horrific.
them inside in their own hallway, like beating them half to death or to death in their own.
And that's we now all know about that because of the heroic campaign by the people in Ballymurphy, and what a wonderful success they've had, and they've brought this that whole scandal to light. Now, my interpretation of it is that it was really, you want to mess with us, we're really gonna beat you up, and no one is gonna be excused, and mothers are gonna be shot, and people are gonna be shot on the ground, and we're gonna let our soldiers do this, and we're not going to do anything to them afterwards. And they didn't. And in fact, the infamous Soldier F, who appears later on in Bloody Sunday, he got a commendation. He was gazetted You can imagine what he was doing on during the Ballymurphy massacre. Now, that's on a massive scale. And the IRA came out, of course. So once the IRA came out, and then the British soldiers engaged with the IRA on the streets, well, then that kicks up the dust. And from a propaganda point of view, the British soldiers can get away with an awful lot. That's what didn't happen in Bloody Sunday. But we leave that aside, at least for the moment. Returning to poison in the water. On a routine, almost daily basis, British soldiers were beating people up. Some absolutely horrific events that I describe in the book. And wherever possible in the book, I use the soldiers' own words. It's not what somebody says they did. Use their own words. And some of it's rather disgusting. I won't quote from the book because some of it's rather disgusting about attacking a young girl who was, maybe special needs and forcing her to do things in huts, beating people up, shooting cats, and just anything to antagonize and make people's life a misery. And I don't, and Kitson was the brigadier in charge of Belfast, and the paratroopers in particular were doing this, and they were known as Kitson's private army. And he took an obsessive role in monitoring absolutely everything they did, and he let this happen, and he didn't stop it. Now remember, this was a man who was well known for being a strict disciplinarian. You cannot be a strict disciplinarian, know what's going on, let this go on unless there's an explanation, and the explanation is that this was poisoning the water. So people, the idea was that people would just start turning to the IRA and say, "Please stop! This is just getting out of control. Our lives are absolute total misery." But that's not what happened. It just inflamed people more, drove more and more people into the hands of the IRA.
Yeah, had the complete opposite effect.
Absolutely. Talk about the throwing fuel on fire. I mean, Kitson was the wrong man, the wrong place at the wrong time. And he after he left, it was all over. There was no chance. I mean, you could have brought Heath and Callaghan back in a week after he left, and it was at that stage it was too late. So now we come back to what you were saying there a moment ago. And I definitely think there's an awful lot in what you're saying as well. Some of these guys were shot at barricades. And the barricades were put up originally to stop Shankill Defence Association and the likes going in, burning people's houses. There's a very famous photograph. I see it now all the time on Twitter feeds of a man in a police uniform dropping a petrol bomb into somebody's house in August of 1969. So they want protection. They put up the barricades. And Kitson saw this as an egregious insult to the crown. The writ of the crown should run everywhere, especially under his watch in Belfast. So they would go out and they'd steal cars. They would get unmarked cars. They would use unattributable guns, not military issue guns. And they'd go by these barricades and they'd shoot at them. And it's a part, yeah, it's a way of saying, don't do that. It's dangerous. Keep away from it. Poison in the water. Poison in the water. Shooting people randomly on the streets. Well, the ones I've looked at, I think that there's certainly an element of that, but there's equally an element that they thought that they might be terrorists. But I mean, it's not good enough. If you have kind of a bad photograph of somebody you drive by, that might be them. Actually, we take a shot at them. I mean, that covers both bases. We might get a target, but even it doesn't matter if it isn't. It's still poison the water.
I was going to say a photo from 1970. I can only imagine what they probably looked like. The other thing is, almost any time one of these instances occurred where MRF would spray like a group of people, and it would turn out they're all innocent, no guns, no nothing, and they always seem to have like this get out of jail free card, which was to say, look, we were fired on. In one case, they said we were fired on by five gunmen, and the five people they fired on had no.
No residue of anything. No, yeah. Oh,
Exactly.
yeah,
So it
absolutely.
does. It does seem as if they could kind of do what they like, and look, if it goes really wrong, you have this get out of jail card that you can pull out any time.
They literally had a license to kill. Literally. I don't like using those type of James Bond cliches because it tends to make it a little bit comic book, but literally, using literally in its correct dictionary sense, they literally had a license to kill. And this brings us to the other huge part of the Kitson philosophy, and that's propaganda. And oh my God, that man realized the importance of propaganda, and also the importance of using the legal world, the legal profession, as part of the war as well. Now, I don't think he was around long enough to really get his teeth into the judiciary and all of that in Belfast, but he knew how to operate the propaganda world as well. Now, one person you should most definitely speak to is the guy I mentioned earlier on, Kieran McGarth. He will give you chapter and verse on what Kitson did. Appalling stuff with regard to the McGurk's bombing. I won't steal Kieran's thunder. I'll let him, if you would like to speak to you, I'm sure he would tell you about that. But what Kitson was at, put the strings he was pulling with media and PR and lying and everything. Unbelievable.
We'll get into that. Yeah, we'll continue on with the propaganda and the kind of psyops stuff. I did want to just go back to the actual MRF themselves. And there's
Sure.
a really good documentary there. I think it was a Panorama one, where they interviewed a few ex-members, and one of them said, I'm almost quoting word for word. He said we were there to act like the IRA. And I read in another book that someone quoted Kitson as saying, sometimes the way to beat terrorists is you have to terrorize them. Have you seen that film? It obviously wasn't out back
Oh,
then, but
yeah.
have you seen that film, Training Day, with Denzel Washington?
I think I have, but I can't remember anything
There,
about it.
there's a
So,
really good line. There's a really good
oh, I do. Yes, I do. The young cop in the car with them and they're going around.
Exactly, exactly. So when that cop kind of started realizing how bad Denzel Washington would act and how much of a criminal he would act, he was kind of asking him why. And your man answered with a really good line. He said, to protect the sheep, you have to catch a wolf, and it takes a wolf to catch a wolf. That last part, takes a wolf. That sounds a lot like their mentality, that they thought it would take someone who's willing to do like terrorist tactics to actually draw out and catch terrorists.
When it gets to that far and you have people saying that type of thing or doing that type of thing, it's too late. The horror, the genie is out of the bottle. That's why I at the outset of this I stress so much about Wilson and James Callaghan, because that's the way you stop it. I mean, when you're back into late 72, and you've got bombs going off the whole time, you've got the UVF weapons. Much at all, and they were up to all the horrors, romper rooms, and God, killing people, and all of that. It's at that stage you just have absolute chaos, and you have li quite literally kicked over all the hornets' nests. How do you put all the How do you fix up the hornets' nests and get them back in and get them back into a calm manner? You can't. So that's why I think it's really, really, really important to look at the very, very roots, the tips of the troubles, how and why it started, instead of just saying, well, you did this, you did that. I mean, all violence is wrong. The IRA were wrong, the UVF were wrong, the SAS, MRF, all of those people were wrong. Anyone who stepped over the line, wrong. Violence is wrong. So I mean, at that stage, you can absolutely understand how that mentality has taken a grip. And then you start attracting the type of people to Ireland who love this type of a world and who take it over and make it their own and engage in even more heinous things. I mean, the Kinkora scandal is just the most obscene scandal, I think, in the history of intelligence, certainly in the Western world. You have, sorry.
I was going to say, if a lot of the theories about like Jeffrey Epstein are to be believed, it sounds like a similar-ish kind of operation, where they would use the public desires of politicians to then they would supply an underage person, and then you have blackmail on them, because assuming you would record or somehow. Yeah, it was almost, if the theories about Epstein are to be believed, yeah.
Well, there's that infamous now painting of Epstein in the dress, dressed up as a woman in Epstein's house. Is very, very strange, and we all know that there were cameras in his house in New York anyway. What is who was he working for? Why? What was the benefit? It will all come out. But look, the Russians have been doing that. sure the Chinese have been doing it. Certainly the MI6 were doing that. Now I don't believe for one second Kitson would have been unaware of what was going on in Kincorra, but I think that was a Maurice Oldfield MI6 operation. And I mean, it's like an onion, one crime after another, you peel it back. I mean, you first of all, you have these unfortunate boys and they've been attacked, raped. That's a crime. And then you have the police not investigating it because they've been told not to. That's a crime. Then you have the people who are perpetrating the crimes being blackmailed. That in itself is a crime. And then they're being asked, well, John McCaig was one of them. They had him entrapped there by 1976, and he went on. He was a Red Hand commander, killing people as well. So they're directing him and his murder gangs. They came down to the Republic, and they killed poor old Mr. Ludlow, and that was covered up as well. So it's just spirals out of control. Kitson, with his drift net intelligence interests, must have known about Kincorra. It's absolutely inconceivable he didn't. And Albert Baker, who was British soldier, some say he was in the SAS, anyway, he's definitely in the British Army. He allegedly deserted and he went in and he joined the UDA. He's come forward, and I believe he was linked with the, everybody believes he was linked with the MRF. He's come forward and he's saying that the UDA knew all about Kincorra, and they were issuing warnings to people to keep away from it. Because one of the fellows who had been who was eventually convicted for the Kincorra scandal, a guy called William McGrath, had been hugely involved in the vigilante groups that eventually coalesced. In fact, he'd written a paper saying, "You various groups, Shankill Defence Association, else we should all get together as one organisation." And that advice was followed, and that became the Ulster Defence Association, the UDA. So the UDA were saying, "Don't go near that place," because they knew exactly what was going on. Now, if the guys in the UDA knew, and the Albert Baker, who's spoken about this, spoke about it on the record to Ken Livingstone, and it's in one of Ken Livingstone's books. There's no way in the world Kitson didn't know about it. No way in the world. So we're dealing with a very unsavory character in Frank Kitson, if he's prepared to tolerate that. It really is the end justifies the means.
Just to bring us back to the MRF and kind of wrap that up, you might tell us about, okay, so we spoke about the attack on the Foursquare laundry van, and also the one of the brothels, and I believe an office were attacked in like within a couple of hours. It was kind of like a three-pronged attack. You might tell us a bit
The
about.
office, I believe, was above the brothel and it was part of it. So that's effectively, in my view, on the arm, I think it was the one.
Oh, interesting. Okay, fair. I didn't know that. You might tell us as well about the ultimate fate of the two Freds that we know about, Seamus Wright and McKee. I believe I've read elsewhere that because they cooperated with the IRA and became triple agents, I suppose they thought their lives were going to be spared, but no.
Yeah, I mean, triple agent is a good description of it. They were really young guys. They were caught in this horrible world. They were being bullied and pressurized by all sides to do everything, and ultimately they were taken across the border and they were not executed for a long time. Various reasons for that. I mean, they had cooperated with the IRA, who were now their captors, and they had helped them smash the Foursquare laundry, expose the MRF, close down those brothels, etc. And one of them, McKee, of course, was related to a very senior Belfast Provisional IRA leader. But in the end, they were shot, they were killed, and their bodies were disappeared. And they were disappeared for decades. Now, the bodies were found eventually. So it's just from a horror story from start to finish. There's nothing but horror involved in that story, unfortunately.
So like to kind of completely almost wrap up the MRF kind of portion of the interview. Okay, so I obviously we mentioned it earlier. A gentleman, I think he was a father of eight, named Pat McVeigh, was killed on the 13th of May 1972. The soldier who's now on trial, the letter moniker they gave him is Soldier F, not to be confused with Bloody Sunday Soldier F. But that same soldier is also being prosecuted for wounding others in the same incident, plus an attempted murder on two people on the previous day. You might tell us a bit about maybe your thoughts or expectations about this upcoming trial that he has.
I'm finding this one perplexing because I'm absolutely convinced that one of the, well, sorry, I'm going to start again. I'm going to move back. This prosecution on its surface looks like it's as a result of interviews given to Panorama. There were a group of alleged ex-MRF people who spoke on Panorama, and they described some of the things that they had done. Now, I believe, and I have very strong grounds for believing, that one of them was a fantasist and a spoof. How he got by Panorama is beyond me. And I don't know, because they're giving code names to these people. I know the guy who's the spoof. I know the pseudonym he uses. I know his real name. I've lost interest in him because he's a spoof. Let him go off and be a spoof if he wants to. He's not going to waste my time. Now I'm interested in him again, because is he the guy who's going to be put on trial? Is this trial then going to explode in the prosecution's face when all of a sudden it's revealed that this guy was couldn't possibly have been involved in it? I mean, he has made comments about missions he was on with the MRF and how they drove along a certain road. That road didn't even exist at the time that mission was taking place. So I'd need really to know if he is or isn't the defendant in this. Is it just a piece of theatre just to throw mud in everybody's water and make people like me look silly and ridiculous and conspiracy theorists and throw egg at our face? I mean, British intelligence not above doing something like that, you know?
They've done,
Or is it one of the genuine guys?
was gonna ask if we're talking about the same documentary, I believe the members in it, there was a guy with a there was a curly guy and there was a fella who had glasses and kind of had like a mustache and a goatee. Are we talking about the same documentary?
That's the documentary, all right.
Are you comfortable saying who you think is the spoofer or what it might jeopardize something?
Well, he wasn't named on Panorama, and I think I'll just leave it like that for the moment. For the moment, if let's just anybody, my people who watch your podcasts, John, are people who are interested in this world, and it's great. Great podcast, by the way. Love it.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Oh, love it, love it. Now that information, let it spread out there and let people sit back and watch. I don't know who's being prosecuted, so I don't know if it is the guy I believe is the spoofer or not. But there's a little exclusive for you, if you like, a piece of brand new information coming out.
Appreciate
So
it.
let's watch that space. And I'm very, very. Anytime you want, I'll come back and we can update this if you like. There's one guy I would love to tell you about called William Black.
Please do, yeah.
Because again, it shows what these MRF guys were up to. William Black was a guy in his 40s. He was a Protestant. He was a religious guy. He was also a very courageous and brave guy. And he seems to me to have been a guy with a moral compass and a brave man. And one night he looks out his window and he sees three fellas robbing a car or robbing a van across the way from him. And courageously he gets his gun and he goes out and he confronts them. And they scarper off, but he captures one of them. A few minutes later, he's holding his gun over the guy, and the guy says, "I'm security, I'm security." And then the other two guys who've escaped, or three guys who've escaped, come back, and then the police start flooding the place. These were MRF guys. So they were out stealing a car so they could go into an area in an unmarked car, and if they were seen, it would be somebody else who would get the blame for it. This man was then brought to the MRF, or brought to a nearby police station. He saw the guys who'd been stealing the car, the guys he tried to arrest, and they had wigs in their hands, and they were British soldiers and the British accents. And you'd think that they would have said, "Look, sorry about that, sorry for giving you a fright." No, they were really arrogant and annoyed at him. And Black decided that he wasn't going to let this lie, and he started making inquiries and making complaints. And then the next thing, there were a couple of assassination attempts around him, but it culminated in he had a cottage in the country in Tully West, and he went down to Tully West, and he was going to sell a water tanker to one of his friends. He goes into his house and he is shot. And a guy called Kennedy Lindsay wrote a book about this, and the book came out around about 79, 80, that type of time. And Kennedy Lindsay described how the guy who shot him was an SAS fellow who'd been flown in to carry out the assassination. And that when he discovered that Black was this honorable guy, he wasn't a terrorist that he'd been told he was. He was viciously upset and annoyed about this. And he went in, actually went into the hospital to see how your man was doing. And he went in his uniform now. I think that was making a statement to people. But is this in the realms of a conspiracy theory or black propaganda from green propaganda from Republican sources? Absolutely not. Because in 1990, Archie Hamilton, the British military, one of the junior ministers for defense, had to admit that yes, he had been killed by soldiers. And of course, it's the usual excuse. They thought he was a terrorist or something. But that doesn't explain why a unit of SAS men were lying in his house for 3 days with guns and shot him. And then they had to compensate him. And they gave him, in today's money, about £30,000 or something like that. So that's also the type of ruthlessness that these MRF guys were engaged in. They were prepared to shoot a member of the Ulster Defence Regiment like that, purely because he was asking questions. So.
I might we spoke about it briefly, but then I took us back to the MRF. Kitson's use of propaganda, and particularly psyops. You might explain to us what a psyop indeed is, and how Kitson went about it.
Well, a psyop is a psychological operation. Now, most of the psychological operations were run by they were run by the regular military, not necessarily Kitson. Colin Wallace was very much involved with it. It was black propaganda, and they'd get photographs of, say, a ship. There was a Russian submarine that came up off Sweden or somewhere like that, and then they pretended that it had come up off Donegal, and they Russians were sending weapons to the IRA. And of course, this was A, to denigrate the IRA in the eyes of the world public, but also, of course, good Catholics wouldn't want to be involved. Sure, they wouldn't with the godless Russians. So all of these type of operations were being run. There was another guy who got caught up. He got caught up with the MRF, actually, and he was involved in a psyops operation. Didn't involve Colin Wallace's team. Now it was another team. I mean, everybody was running psychological operations, but the whole thing was used to try and they used him to go to journalists to say, "Look, I'm in the IRA," and it was known he was in the IRA, and tell them that there was fiddling of money and things like that. So they were sowing seeds of dissension within organizations. Another soldier altogether told me once, told me about 5 or 6 years ago, how when he was in Belfast in 73, 74, he would go and steal weapons. This is a brave man. He would steal weapons from the provisionals and then go over to the official IRA, the organization split. And he'd plant the weapons in an arms cache belonging to the officials, and then they would spread the word around. So all of this is causing dissension, internecine feuding. And so how much of the, and I mean, the provisionals and the officials did, of course, engage in internecine feuding, and they were shooting each other. So that's a psychological operation. So how much of that Kitson was involved, I don't really know. That's an area that has yet to be discovered, but you can be damn sure he was. He used to visit Colin Wallace a lot and sit in Colin Wallace's red chair in his office and ask Colin questions. And he wouldn't necessarily now let Colin know what he was up to, but he was consulting with psyops, finding out information. So he was definitely involved in some of them, all right.
You mentioned in your book there was this one journalist who pretty much would drive and meet Kitson and then just copy and paste what Kitson said into his article, essentially.
And did so, if I can say so, in good faith. He didn't realize that he was being taken for a ride, and believed it. And he would say he was quite naive, and later on really came to regret it, and hence admitted it and exposed it and wrote about it. So I think we'll give him a pass. We won't say he wasn't a bought and sold mouthpiece for propaganda purposes.
Just one more thing on Albert Baker. He said, and it's I got this from your book,
Oh,
that the RUC had knowledge and even supported a lot of their hit teams, and he said that most of the murders committed by them in that early 70s wouldn't have been able to take place at all if not
yes.
for support. Specifically, he mentioned I'm not sure who he said supplied the guns, but some security force
Yeah.
members supplied guns and then even collected them after the hit, so that then if you and me do a hit and go through a checkpoint, we won't have the guns with them. That's that is horrific. Like,
I'm very suspicious about Baker. I don't I'm not convinced that he deserted. I think he was recruited into an MRF type operation. When we say MRF, that's one I'm using that, and it should always be used in kind of a really flexible way. Dirty tricks might be even better way. Military intelligence, civilian intelligence, dirty tricks, and they're all overlapping and they're all interconnected. So you have this guy. He is a soldier. He's from Belfast. He comes back to Belfast. He deserts allegedly, and he gets in with the UDA. And before you know it, he is the bodyguard to one of the bodyguards to the inner council of the UDA. And he
To
is,
Heron, right?
yeah, Heron, and Heron was a British agent. And on Baker's account, he was. He exposes him as Baker exposes Heron as a British agent, but I think Baker was already a British agent, and he was meeting with various people in coffee shops, and they were running him. Full details of it may yet come out because Baker's still alive. He was spent a long time in prison. He spoke out a lot, but he hasn't told us everything he knows. But let's go back to what he did. He was involved in a whole string of horrific killings, one of which involved a fellow, a very, very brave man called Heenan, who was going to work with his workmates on a bus, and a Baker's gang came along, threw a grenade in the window, and this man leapt forward and got in the way of the grenade, went over it and saved his friends, but he died. Now his family are suing the Ministry of Defence in Kitson because Baker was a British agent, you see.
At the time of that attack.
At the time of that attack, yeah. Now again, this is after Kitson has gone, but Kitson set everything up, and then he was pushed out. He didn't go voluntarily, and he went before his time too. Baker goes back to England. He has some type of a nervous breakdown, and he confesses to the Warminster police. And at that stage, the cat's out of the bag, because whatever about controlling events in maybe Belfast or something like that, when you have someone going into the Warminster police and confessing to a string of killings, the cat is now out of the bag. So damage limitation becomes the order of the day. He's put on trial, and look, at the end of the day, it doesn't come out that he's a British agent, but a whole lot of horrific murders are exposed. He goes to prison. He's in prison, and he becomes annoyed and starts speaking to various people. And I have a handwritten account note of well, of what he said was going on. And it seems to me that the RUC in Monpottinger station were up to their arms in all types of shenanigans. Murderous shenanigans, and as you exactly as you said, they had they gave the names of people that they wanted killed to the UDA, to Baker's gang. The Baker's gang would go out with Ned McCreary was involved in it, I think, and others. They would kill these people, and one of the techniques was exactly as you would describe it. They would be able to drive wherever they wanted in Belfast, because if they were stopped, they were never armed. The RUC would then. These corrupt RUC officers would then give them the guns. They would then carry out the hit, give the gun back to the RUC special branch guys, and then they could drive off. And again, which there might be some residue on them if they were examined, something like that, but there were no weapons on them, no guns on them. And Baker was connected with the MRF, I believe. His code name was Agent Broccoli. And there's documentation which has emerged where they're referring to at the highest possible level, really high military figures talking about Agent Broccoli and how is he and all of that. And it's your man Baker. So it wasn't just MRF and military soldiers in Kitson. I mean, the RUC Special Branch were part of this system of murder. And that is why Kitson and the MRF and spawned that other thing. We haven't spoken about it at all, which is. Collusion with terrorists, state collusion with terrorists, which is now well known. I think so many people have exposed what's going on there. We need hardly go through it here, but that was the start of it, I believe.
Okay, so the Emerald, obviously a lot of this took place like in the shadows, and it's not quite clear, but it's thought that after the MRF was packed up and was no longer operational, that the group that kind of took over doing that type of stuff was called the Special Reconnaissance Unit.
Yeah,
Later,
14th.
it was later
Yeah.
the FRU, which is mo most famous for running Agent State and Freddy
Yeah.
Scott. You might tell us about the I guess the kind of descendants of the MRF.
Well, if you're you could drive yourself crazy trying to unravel all of these names and all of these false names and then all of the cover names, and is the cover name a real name or a false name? But yeah, the SRU were the next one there. The MRF, a couple of their soldiers got caught in a car with Thompson machine guns. What were they carrying Thompson machine guns for? Those were not standard army issue at the time. Those were the type of guns that the IRA had. So that, and they've been shooting and involved in incidents and that. So all whilst they pretty much got away with all of that, the cat was out of the bag, and Foursquare Laundry and the attack on the brothel and all of that, cat was out of the bag. The MRF was Maria abolished, and there's some internal reports that have surfaced saying that they were kind of ill-disciplined and everything, which they were. And so they decided basically they were going to do exactly the same thing, change the name but run the ship a bit tighter, and that was where the SRU came in. And you can, like I said, you can go through this alphabet soup of names and all the rest of it, but it boils down to something very, very, very simple, which is Kitson's experiment. They deemed it to be a great success. They deemed it to be the way ahead. They deemed it as the blueprint for the future, and they followed it all the way right up to the Force Reconnaissance Unit, the FRU. And it's just variations on a theme. And I think I might have said earlier on that the thing you've got to look at is that this is flexible. This is not, the rules of chess on a chessboard. This piece can move that way. No. These pieces can move any way they want when we want to, and we'll cover it up, and we'll lie, and we'll deceive, and we'll manipulate everything, and you can quite literally get away with murder. So you've all types of opportunities arising, and then you have bespoke units set up to run it. I mean, what was Robert Nirach doing? I mean, that's very strange stuff. Who was controlling him? And then your various competing intelligence organizations, but it all keeps coming back to this. They had collusive arrangements with loyalists they controlled to take out people that they saw as their enemies. They poisoned the waters from time to time, but not so much in later years, as far as I can see. Well, certainly nothing of the extent of Ballymurphy. And then there was the Stalker thing much later on. That was really, really, really bizarre. The RUC recruited a lot of former British soldiers, SAS type guys, and then they went out and they would monitor and watch, follow suspects, and then when they'd come to the checkpoints, they'd just shoot them dead, shoot to kill. And then there was the famous hay shed where they found guns, and then two kids, total innocent kids, went in there and they went down and they just shot them. But so these were British soldiers dressed up as police officers pretending that they were being attacked again and shooting people. And then John Stalker, the deputy chief constable of Manchester, went and investigated and got too close to the truth and wouldn't back off, so they had to smear him and get rid of him. But again, at the end of the day, this is just extrajudicial killings, assassinations, murder, been perpetrated by the state in one guise or another, and they're getting away with it. And it all goes back to the MRF.
We'll wrap up soon enough. But yeah, there's a few figures in your book that are kind of tangentially related to Kitson.
Okay.
Derek Wilford, known as the Butcher, by some. You might talk to us a little about him and the link there to Kitson.
Well, I'll do this briefly because I can't do it long, because half the book is about Wilford. The first quarter of the book is really about Kitson's history, and then the next quarter is what he does in Belfast, and then the next thing is my theory that Bloody Sunday, that Savile got it completely wrong. Don't ask me questions about Savile because I don't want to get annoyed. Savile got it wrong, and what Bloody Sunday was about was it was a an attempt to flush the IRA in Derry out onto the streets. And Wilford was one para, and he was in Belfast, and he reported to Kitson, and he was sent Mariah to sorry, for the benefit of Americans, when I say Mariah, I mean, yeah, really, I don't believe you, Mariah. He was sent on this day to Bloody Sunday, and I spend 100 or so pages in the book putting forward the evidence for what I think happened was this. One para hadn't, they were not sent there to quash a few rioters, arrest them, put them into the back of a van and have them hauled up before the beak. No, they were there to take out the IRA. Free Derry, so-called, because there were no British soldiers, they couldn't get in. And the idea was sending these soldiers on foot of faulty MI5 evidence from a deceitful agent called Observer B at the Savile Inquiry. His real name was James Miller. And Miller was feeding nonsense for money back to the to MI5 and to military intelligence, saying that the IRA are armed, there's going to be 40 gunmen there. And of course, this is fabulous news to the likes of Kitson. We'll go in there, we'll get them shooting, and we'll take them out, and we'll root out the IRA. The writ of the Crown will now run in Derry as it runs in Belfast. Except the MI5 military intelligence operative, Observer B, Jimmy Miller, was lying. He was making it up. And the truth of it is that the IRA had agreed with the civil rights people who were marching that day that they would leave it be. You can have your day, we won't be involved. And they were not active, they were not there, weapons were removed, etc. But the British, Wilford's one para, responsible and answerable to Kitson in the chain of command, goes to Derry that day, and we know what happened. And I believe all the evidence shows that these guys were shooting in the hope that the IRA, 40 or 50 IRA fellas they believed were there and had been training there, were going to come and shoot back at them, and they would beat them on the streets, and they didn't. And then the whole thing fell apart. And that was, you could call that a kind of a military slash psyop operation, and it backfired dreadfully. And I spoke to a very, 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 very senior IRA figure who told me he was running a training camp on the day, and he had to physically restrain some of the younger guys who wanted to take the guns they were being trained with. I think, well, he wouldn't tell me where they were being trained, but I think it was up the Donegal Mountains. And you had to physically restrain them. So this was the anger. And if you look in the movie, I don't know if it's artistic license or not, but if you look at the movie about Bloody Sunday with James Nesbitt, one of the closing scenes, you see a big queue of people, and I think it's in a flat queuing up to join the IRA. Now, I'm sure it wasn't that obvious, but people were queuing up to join the IRA. And I believe that Kitson created this atmosphere, and I believe Kitson knew in advance that this was the plan. And there are indications that he was, because of what he said to Wilford when Wilford returned. He asked him, well, when you got in there, why didn't you go the whole way? Not what the hell were you doing? You can read a lot into a statement like that. So I think Kitson will go down as biggest mistake of the early troubles, the man who threw petrol on a fire, and the genie now is truly out of the bag, and we had 30 years of horror after that, and it was avoidable. A lot of it was avoidable, I think, anyway.
Thank you very much. Now, everything you've shared, all the knowledge, everything that's in anyone who's interested in watching this episode, you'll love the book. It's what we've spoken about, but in quite a bit more detail. Is there anything you want to leave us with there? Anything you wanted to mention? We can get the chance.
Oh, my voice is going a little bit hoise now. Oh, look, listen, I could keep going, but I won't. I think we've covered enough. I think it's enough. I'd very happily come back another day if you want.
I'd love to. Absolutely. Are you okay to talk to mention your that you have a book coming out?
Oh, absolutely. Why not?
Please.
Yeah, the tentative title of it is Spies in the Camp, and it's about Patrick Crinion and his cat and mouse game with Sean McStay from the Chief of Staff of the IRA. Patrick Crinion was a Garda officer who was in the most secret, higher up, more secretive than the special branch here in the Republic, a unit called C3, and he had access to every single secret that came in. His job was to collate every report from the special branch, and he was giving it to the British Secret Service. So it's that, and it's all what was going on in the Republic of Ireland, mainly in the early 1970s, when very similar things were happening down here. Little John brothers were robbing banks for the British Secret Service and that. So that's hopefully going to come out in March or April of 2024. So thank you
Well,
for that opportunity.
all good stuff. Okay,
Yeah.
absolutely. We'll speak again. We'll speak again when it comes out. It sounds fascinating. I know very, very little about like kind of anything that the guards did or what you're talking about happening in the Republic. It's easy to think of it, other than Dublin Manhattan bombings. It's easy to think of it as just this extremely localized thing. Very good.
I think every writer says, "Oh, this book, lots of new information." This one coming out, I have to revisit some stuff I've already written about because the narrative will be incoherent otherwise. It's about 100,000 words, and there is loads of new information, brand new information, stuff that's never ever come out before.
Thank you very much again. Pleasure speaking to you.
Oh, the
Great
pleasure's been all
meeting.
mine. I've been
Thank
looking
you.
forward to this, and I've been watching your podcast for a long time now. So well done. You're doing a great job, and I'm really honored to have been invited. Thank you so much.
So that means the world to me. Thank